What did you come to? We doing the whole thing again? So we just do that.
I'm sure we can send to the king.
What? You ready? So what time did you get it back? This early, too.
But he's all better now.
But the plane was fine. And we were actually going to come back, rebook the hotel, go back the next day, check out, go back the next day, and come back to the hotel. It was like 3 days.
Shoot us if you want to.
These are all the things that we want to get. And I think the thing is, you know, it's going to get really bad. You know, it's going to get really bad.
down. Is this better? Yeah. So this one is dead. Okay. All right. How much did this group pay you to wake up this early and be here? And if you didn't get paid, you should find out why. But I know half of you there.
You might want to check they know why they're here, Fadi.
Good morning to all of you. I just, honestly, I wasn't planning to be here. I have a meeting waiting for me elsewhere. But I had the real privilege to chat for a few minutes with Jean-François with the coffee earlier this morning. And I came to, first and foremost, and again, because I'll be doing this many times, but at least I'll do it this morning again, to thank each member sitting at this table for the incredible, not just work you produced, but spirit with which you produced your work. It's really amazing. The more I think about how you came together from very different schools of thought, different backgrounds, and you produced something on the one issue I was told when I came at ICANN is intractable. Don't even bother, I was told by some people in the community, because we'll never get there. We've been at it for 10 years. Why do you think this group will advance us even an inch? Well, frankly, for someone who's not read in detail but skimmed, I did skim the report. It is amazing. You didn't move us an inch, you moved us a mile. And thank you for that. The spirit with which you did this, I just asked Denise, should be recorded. In other words, not just the report and the substance, but how you did it is also a guide for us how to do, to attack very complex things in the future. I think with humility, the rest of the community should take your work and understand the spirit that got it here, and hopefully, with leadership, but also with conviction, we will take this work and turn it into something that the DNS system will advance because of. Because this is a huge advancement of the DNS system on which everything else we're doing builds. But yet some of its foundations need to be fixed, and you have made that step forward. So I don't know how else to thank you, but I'll keep thanking you for the next few months. And as I just told one of you, unfortunately, so this is the bad news, when you create something this good, this important, you cannot just leave it and go away. So we need you to work within the community to ensure that this work is watered. You just put seeds in the ground. They need to be watered. They need to be maintained so that they can grow into something we can all benefit from. So please do not... I know you're exhausted. I heard you met almost daily for months now. Daily? For months? Mind-boggling. I don't know of any other volunteer group that met daily for months. Oh, you know, this is really incredible. But please, with all of this, take a day off, but then come back. Okay, 2 days.
Only one day, Fadi?
Two.
Okay,
two,
thanks.
Okay, 2 days off, and then please come back and believe that this is your opus, and it needs work, it needs attention, but you need to give it up to the community. That's part of the game as well. It is not yours. The genius of this would be that you brought it to us, and now you need to let us own it. But to do so, it takes effort as well. And we will call on you. We will call on you as we move forward. But you have my commitment, and I know Chris's commitment and Steve's commitment on the board, to not let this thing not bear fruit. It has to bear fruit. So thanks again, really, sincerely to all of you. I think everyone in the community, as they get to know you and know what you did, and know the substance of what you did, will be equally thankful. Have a great day.
Thank you very much, Fadi, for these nice words. It means a lot for us, for the recognition. Doesn't mean that what we've said is right, but at least we've done our best to digest these very, very complex elements to make it a proposal that we have today. So I think it's a very much the stick in the ground of for the community to look at what these difficult issues could be. And as we said on Monday during the public session, that we spent already one hour and then 2 hours of Q&A. And I'm very, very pleased to see that even today, for another 2 hours, we get still a lot of people attending and willing to help us to digest further on how we can make it appropriate. Also, on behalf of EWG, I can say that we are very, very committed to not let it go this way. We are not going to direct anything, but we are going to be at the disposal of anyone who wants to do something substantial with this report to help, and definitely for the benefit of the overall community. So that's our commitment. We cannot escape, and we'll never escape. We have a big commitment on this one. This is a group of volunteers. We have done that on top of their work. And as you said, it's a daily type of task. So we are very, very, in our heart, it's very, very warm for us to make sure that this is useful for the community. With that, I pass to our fantastic moderator, Chris, for turning the Q&A session
Thanks,
into a success.
Jean-François. Okay, who was here on Monday, please? Okay, so new people, which is kind of encouraging. You were here and you weren't here. Okay. So we're just kind of continuing on a discussion about the report, and I guess really it's up to you guys what you want to talk about. So does anybody have anything they want to say? I mean, do you want us to look at a particular aspect of the report? Does somebody want to volunteer something for us to talk about? Do we still have questions and comments? This is supposed to be an open discussion session, and we weren't planning on doing any presentations because we did those on Monday. No one? Because we can all go and have coffee if you don't want to talk. If you'd all just turned up to see what we would say, we're not saying anything. Jay Scott, thank you.
Adobe Systems, and I'm also a president-elect of the International Trademark Association. My question is, what are we getting that's better for us than we are now? I know that for privacy concerns, registrants are getting less public information that is available to anonymous requesters. But what's the trade-off that would have a company like Adobe, which is seeking to stop the unauthorized distribution of our software and trying to find the illegal participants, what's in it for me that would be better for me than what I have today?
So, leaving aside the obvious question, which is why there should be anything in it for you, but Fab, Susan, Michaeli, you go.
Yes, I'm just for everybody in the room. If I vanish shortly, it's not because you've all offended me. It's just I've ended up triple booked.
Right, thank you for that. Did you get that, Scott? That's the answer to your question.
Thanks.
Michaeli is triple booked.
You can't. There's a couple of things that we think we've come up with which might be a help to you. One of the issues that intellectual property owners, business owners, and law enforcement in the broad context have raised in the past is the kind of scenario where somebody will go off and they will register domain names that use a famous mark. So, for example, in the case of Adobe, if I was to go off and register Adobe Creative something something dot whatever, at present I could easily put in all of your corporate details with the exception of, say, the email address. So in terms of passing ICANN's policies with respect to who is syntax, validation, verification, etc., 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 and you can verify and validate it up until whatever, under normal circumstances, that would pass right through, because obviously it would be syntactically correct. But you'd be kind of scratching your head going, you know, we didn't register that domain name, what the hell? We're a much smaller company than Adobe, and we've had this happen to us. We've had scenarios where we get, how do I refer to them, nasty grams from lawyers demanding that we take down websites, and we're kind of scratching our heads going, we don't have that website. And it turns out that somebody's actually used our contact details. So that aspect is one part of it. Again, some of the stuff that we've put forward is purely optional, so that in the case of a large company like yourselves that probably has quite a large portfolio of domain names, plus you're dealing with issues around domain names being registered that are going to cause you problems at one level or another, you could optionally, and please note this is optional, set it up in such a way that nobody else could use your physical address and things like that. I think that is something that you don't currently have under the current system. I don't think there's any way to have that under the current system. And I think for quite a small business, that's actually quite a nice idea. I'll hand over to the others since that's more their area than mine.
Yeah. So, mind you, I mean, you asked from an infringement enforcement perspective, so no need to cover a lot of stuff because I think we've enumerated a lot of benefits for people. But I think the big ticket item is access to accurate data, right? I mean, one of our slides that I had the pleasure of presenting was our little garbage can that said they're full of garbage. Hopefully, we don't have to say that going forward if this gets implemented. We won't have in 5 or 10 years another slide that says I'm full of garbage. And to get that accuracy, we've operated on the premise twofold. One, that gating people's data raises the level or incentive to put in accurate data, and that building an accountability structure that has a first step of credentialing or authenticating users who access that data for a certain purpose also drives higher incentives for accurate data. People don't need to hide or falsify their data because they don't need to worry about kind of the drive-by, just anyone can pick up your PPI, right? So for you, as a brand owner and corporation, I think the two things to think about or to focus on, and I think it's a legitimate question because as we've all worked on this group, we've worked on principles, right? A lot of what we've said are principles, recommendations. They don't then, for the majority of the 180 principles we put out, we haven't then gone through and flushed out every single detail of what is an authentication system. So I would focus on, is the authentication a proper bargain for exchange for the accuracy we think we're going to get? Is the gating a proper bargain for exchange for that? And I think that that's all going to come down to the implementation details, because if in authentication, everyone's going to be asked for a blood sample for possibly more accurate data, I'd argue maybe that's not a proper bargain for exchange. So, you know, look at the principles, and then I think when the community digests this and goes through a policy development process, those are the things you should think about.
Does anybody else want to, Susan?
So one thing that I think will be really helpful to the community in general is identifying the proxy services. In the minimum public data set, there will be that proxy ID. You will have their number. And once you've found out their processes, then you will know what to do each time. And we're relying on the PPSAI working group to define all of that. But simply knowing, yes, this is a proxy, this isn't some sort of strange registrant information that really is not a proxy, so that you don't have to do that judgment call. And then having clearly identified processes, and you would know where you have a right to ask for the reveal of the registrant information and where you would not, that would be at the proxy vendor site, services site. But still, not having to go through that analysis each time, and hopefully the proxy working group will also ensure that the proxy vendor responds, because in today's state, Most of them do not, in my experience. So I think that proxy ID is crucial going forward.
Rod.
And just one other bit that's in there that I think makes the job easier or potentially easier for both trademark purposes and abuse investigations and the like is the concept of, two concepts, one of who was and also of a, to some extent, reverse who is search. So you can, once you have been authenticated, et cetera, to get into the information for the purpose of determining if there are additional domain names that are also in that, a potential for infringing or what have you, or a part of a botnet, whatever, then you've got that capability built into the system.
Okay. next, Alex.
Hi. So Alex Deakin with the MPAA. So I just want to continue this discussion about identity verification. I understand it's optional, and I know how difficult it is to do true identity validation in the global context, but I also know that optional features often are not implemented, right? Being someone who's written specs and both implemented specs. So I'm curious kind of to get more understanding about the discussions you had and the thought process you had with regard to optional identity validation. And for example, what's the incentive for a validator to actually verify and validate and authenticate the true identity of the user?
Sorry, I'm going to need to... validation's not...
And I may be using the terms incorrectly.
Rod, do you go?
So, well, there are a lot of incentives. One could be, well, you have to take and put the whole thread through here, too. What is the incentive for the validator? I would assume that they're going to get some sort of compensation for providing a level of validation as one way of doing it. Or
for if I'm not incorrect, I think what he's going at is we have three levels of validation: syntactic, operational, and then identity. Actually,
right. I'm talking about identity validation. But what's that's what you were asking about.
But what's the incentive to actually have people do that final one, the third one?
Why would someone pay a validator to do that?
For identity validation, right? The optional.
Yes.
I can answer.
Right. Yeah, and that's you want to go ahead instead? That's fine.
No,
okay. If you want to add more, feel free.
Sorry.
So if I am, you have to take a look at the type of registrant that's involved here, right? So for a business or somebody who is doing commerce on the internet, there's a strong incentive, two strong incentives. One is that you would have an identity validated contact. That would be, and there is that information, the level of validation and the last time it was checked are published.
Right.
So that is something that a consumer could go take a look at, or somebody who's doing reputation or et cetera could go look at and say, this e-commerce site has been identity validated in the Whois or in the RDS system. There's also this concept around protecting my personal or my business credentials from being misused, which was already brought up, so that if I have something identity validated, I can then say nobody else can use this address and phone number in their contact details. This is mine. I've been identity validated to that level. So the guy down the street who steals your credit card or wants to impersonate a business is blocked from being able to do that. So those are two, actually quite different, but very strong incentives for wanting to do that.
If that individual who stole that identity goes to another validator that doesn't verify the identity,
well, no, the
right.
So
yes. Is there something already there?
Yeah. So the idea would there be a mechanism in the system for you to be able to say this particular set of contact details has been identity validated and cannot be used without the authorization of that contact holder, where they're tied to.
All right.
Did you want to add something, Susan? Or?
No.
Okay.
Great job.
Excellent. Does anybody else want to say anything? No. Okay. Wendy, are you walking to the microphone or just standing quietly in the corner?
Well, I would love it if there were a printed copy of this that I could page through more quickly than scrolling through my documents on screen, but that aside.
You provide your own trees. It's...
I, among other things, I'm trying to understand all of the language and implications here. I find principle 8 nearly impossible to read.
Somebody like to talk to principle 8? Says we'll go through it slowly, otherwise we'll all get lost. I don't have a copy in front of me, so.
At least one purpose-based contact must be provided for every registered domain name which makes public the union of all mandatory data elements for all mandatory PBCs. This PBC must be syntactically accurate and operationally reachable to meet the needs of every codified permissible purpose.
Yep.
Yes.
Makes sense to me. So we'll happily talk about that, and just to say that all of us acknowledge that in order to put this together, there have had to be acronyms created and strings of words created and so on. And the report does sit as a whole and does need to be read as a whole. And we acknowledge that that is incredibly hard work to do. And we acknowledge that, just so that we're all clear, because I said this on Monday, nothing is going to happen following this meeting to suddenly see all of this stuff implemented. So there's a huge amount of work to be done before we get any further. But Carlton, would you like to answer the question?
Okay. If you notice, there is the principle is that for every data element that is collected, there must be a purpose. And every purpose must be permissible. So you start at that level. And
does that not make sense, Winnie? There has to be a purpose.
Every element that's connected, you don't collect an element without establishing a reason to collect it. Every data element must have a reason and purpose to be collected. First principle. Second...
Permissible defined by...
No, we didn't
the
say...
...the set of reasons that you've allocated...
Permissible defined by whatever the policy ends up being.
Right.
But not as defined by an outside review or court determining that for some users those purposes are not permissible, for example.
Well, of course, if a court decides that a purpose is not permissible, then it's not permissible, but only in that country.
Yeah.
Not anywhere else.
Presumably there is a policy perspective, a policy framework that will decide what is permissible or not. I mean, this is going into the policy development process, but the standard floor level principle is you may not collect a data element unless it is purposeful.
Wendy, can I ask you what perhaps to come at it from the other way is what's wrong with saying that every piece of data that's collected has to have a purpose? That's an approved purpose or a principal purpose. What's wrong with that? In other words, what we're saying is you can't just decide to collect somebody's inside leg measurement because you feel like it. You've actually got to have a justified, acceptable purpose for collecting it, and that falls into a series of buckets. One of those buckets, for example, it would be legal contact.
If you'd actually let me respond, when reading this text, I could easily get the impression that if I were able to come up with a new use for which... for some purpose, it would be permissible to have that. For example, I have the height measurement of the criminal who was viewed leaving the scene of the disrupted ATM, and knowing his inseam measurement would help me determine whether this registrant was the person who had been stopped on the scene. It would be permissible to have that information. Therefore, should I be able to throw it in here?
But it would only be permissible if the policy, A, allowed that information to be collected in the first place. So there's a policy in place that says this is the information that needs to be collected. There's a bucket full of information. Yeah, you go ahead.
Let's get to the second part.
No, hang on, Carlton. It's really important that we go through it slowly so that everybody understands. So, Susan, let's deal with the first part.
I think my problem here is that the text of this principle makes it appear that if I can develop a new purpose for which I need information and for which everyone will agree that in some cases it is legitimate to have that information, and I can codify it, then it can be made mandatory to collect. Now, if that's not the intent, the language could be clarified to make that apparent.
So, Wendy, it's not the intent that you can create anything because you are not the community. This is just a representation of what we as representatives or a reflection of the community thought as a sample, our best effort of what purposes could be. But what I think what Chris is trying to tell you is that what ultimately becomes the purposes, permissible purposes, is going to be defined by the community. So I or you can't ever come up with the inseam or the height because it won't pass muster with the community. It wouldn't pass a vote in this room. And so the reality is, if it won't pass muster in this room, it won't pass muster with the ICANN community, and it sure as hell is not going to pass muster with governments in the countries, which is also going to be. So it's going to be a complete feeding in process that will determine ultimately what those purposes are. So you don't have to think or feel as though any one of us is going to come up with a purpose like the inseam or height, because no matter how hard I tried, it's not going to happen. So I guess if you start from the premise that I can come up with a purpose, your starting point is wrong, because you or I can't do it.
And I am simply trying to say that I don't think I'm being unreasonable in saying that's not apparent from the language of your report, and so I'm asking as a member of the community for clarification of the language that you have printed and distributed to help others who are reading through this material to understand that the mandatory union of every codified permissible purpose is rooted in purposes accepted by the community.
Well, and that's why during our Monday session, I believe, when Susan presented this section and had the slide on permissible purposes, she actually made the point at the beginning and at the end of her five slides that this was our best attempt at, but that we probably didn't get a holistic view and we probably didn't get it 100% right. We could only do what we could, and we're going to have to rely on the community to finish it off. So that was clarifying then, and we're just going to reiterate that clarification now.
You guys finish? So did you have the clarification?
I hear clarifications that are could usefully be added to this text.
Well, so first of all, let's be really clear. We're not adding anything to the text. The report is the report. But I thought we had established, had we not, that this is a report which is going to then end up at some point after a whole series of processes in a GNSO policy development process. And that's where you need to be doing the work on what the principles would be and what the all of that sort of stuff. I acknowledge completely that you might not find a particular paragraph or a particular series of paragraphs clear. I get that, but that's a drafting style. As a lawyer, I know that I can read some lawyer's stuff better than others, for example. But the key is to understand that all of this is going to go into a discussion that you guys are going to be leading as the GNSO, but I've got Stephanie, and then I've got Rod, and then come back to you, Wendy.
I think Wendy's clarified. I just wanted to bring us back to her original point, which was that the wording of that particular principle is quite confusing, an opinion I share. And I must say, I don't know why we can't fix it, because I bet we're going to hear it often.
It doesn't matter how many times we hear it. We have produced a report.
Okay, Chris.
Hang on. We have produced a report, and we're happy to clarify, but we're not going to go back and rewrite the report. I've got Rod, and then I've got Michele.
Right, and to that last point is what I wanted to speak to, and everybody's concerns here that when we have a fundamental thing like this that a lot of people are saying is confusing, we've already started. I don't know if the VAC has been put up yet. I think it has been online. So we want to address exactly these issues and get clarification language. And if you still find it confusing, help us by you're listening. I think we are agreeing on what we actually want to have see happen here. And I know we did on the working group. So if you can suggest some language that would clarify it in your mind, submit that. And we are still cogitating on this feedback so that we can make it clear as going forward in this process what the intent of these various principles is.
Hang on. What, Susan first.
Thank you. It's very difficult to read one principle and pull it out. So read it. Read all of the principles. It's a lot. But principle 4 also speaks to that. There's a process. We definitely saw that technologies innovates constantly. There are new things that may come up that, believe it or not, we didn't think of. I mean, you know, if I had, we'd all be in new businesses. So, you know, we tried to accommodate letting the community have some sort of process to define a new purpose and decide if it was permissible and add it to the data set. So we don't want static. We don't want to be working in 1980 data elements. So read all of these principles together, and then you'll have a more comprehensive view.
Do you want to come back and say something, carry on? Because I'm happy to for this to go as long as you guys want. It's just that I'm not clear what Michele.
Thanks, Chris. Cruel and unusual punishment forcing anybody to deal with this is 8 o'clock in the morning. Especially me. I don't do mornings particularly well. Yeah, and yes, they all know that. With respect to the levels of confusion around terminology and everything else, I tend to agree that we need to be able to clarify these things. I don't want a situation, Wendy, where we're arguing over a definition of something that's because the way it's worded is awkward or unclear. I mean, that I'm more than happy to end up debating things where it's substantive, but if it's just because we haven't explained it very well, then we need to be able to clarify it. And if that means we add some kind of, I don't know, FAQ or something like that, so be it. I think what could be a potential, the kind of issue that I think has come up here a couple of times, and maybe the way we're responding isn't helpful, and it's not intentional, and from my side it's because it's this early in the morning and I'm using that excuse and sticking to it. The report itself is done. We can't change that because people will have grabbed the report, downloaded it, considered it to be definitive, and if you change it, how are they going to know that there's a new version of it out there? But adding extra materials to clarify all of this, if that needs what needs to happen, then let's do it.
And further in the sort of drafting clarity question, I haven't found definitions of lots of these terms in a way that would allow me to say, for example, permissible purpose is clearly limited by the risk analysis that has to be done against whether, even if it the community has identified a permissible purpose, it might nonetheless be impermissible to collect a piece of data because the risk analysis layered on top of that has determined that the data should not be collected. The risk of its collection outweighs the value it might have for those permissible purposes. I guess left to those of us who subsequently read and parse the report to pull together those diagrams to come to the ultimate limitation of what appears from the text to be a very categorical statement that anything permissible will be collected. I'll leave the line to others and come back with further questions later, I'm sure.
Kathy, you're next.
I'm going to run the queue for a second on this side, Chris. And I have a question for Michele before he leaves. So I think he's leaving. He needs to ask Michele and Chuck has a follow-up.
This is fantastic.
Is this kind of beat up Michele time?
Who's going first? Mike, you're
going. I'm staying for a few minutes, but I've got to go.
So, Mike, you go.
I'll make this real quick. Thank you. One of the things we heard yesterday in the GAC was about certain classes of TLDs that will require additional verification elements. I myself am working with a number of financial services clients, also working with the sports community where you might have different memberships. Is any of those elements that might be collected by a registry somehow encompassed, or are you only looking at the minimum baseline data?
Do you mean like dot bank and dot
credit union?
So the requirement of the TLD is that you must be a whatever in order to use the TLD.
Yeah, Chris, I can speak to that a bit. The way we looked at a lot of this is that if you needed to add extra contact data, extra data elements specifically for that kind of thing, so I can imagine. Okay, financial institution collecting something. If it's a sports club thing, maybe it's some kind of membership number. We also looked at concepts like, let's say, if somebody wanted to add their Twitter handle as a way of contacting them. You know, that the technically speaking, there should be no limitation. So to answer you, it's a non-issue. Yeah, it can be done. Scott can probably speak to the more technical elements of that, but it is. And we did think about this.
And it would make it, if one agreed that one should have these...
Well, obviously.
...restricted use TLDs, it would make it easier because you'd be able to bolt things onto this particular system, which you can't really do right now. Scott,
and Scott, in the context of .me, where there are certain additional elements that are added in DNS...
Yeah, indeed. I think it'd be a very difficult task for us to try to enumerate all of the possible data elements that might possibly appear in TLDs, you know, yet to be identified... So rather than trying to come up with an endless set of elements, we focused instead on what we thought the minimal set would look like, with a recognition that both the provisioning protocol, EPP, and the resolution protocol, RDAP, are extensible, and elements can be added with community consensus.
Continue to the session. So just on that, let me just issue the warning. It has nothing to do with the question. The warning of the slippery slope, that fields we heard were optional in Singapore are now mandatory. Legal of contact abuse contacts. So once some people start asking for it and start requiring it of everybody, whether or not it's a fit, it's a slippery slope.
I think it's really important that we try and dialogue on all of these points. So I want to get through everything if I can, point by point. I know it can be annoying, but I think it's actually important. Have we made some stuff that was an optional contact purpose in Singapore now mandatory?
Yes.
Hang on.
Yes.
So we changed. We after the feedback that we got in Singapore, we went away and we worked on what we thought the mandatory one should be. Right, okay, cool. Susan?
But I think it's how you view it, too. And obviously, Kathy...
I'm a lawyer, I know.
I
know how few people have legal contacts.
Right, but the way I... And this is a personal... But the way I view it is I find it helpful that I can say, you know, this is the legal contact or this is the abuse contact for Facebook. I understand that is not for every registrant. But I think it does provide you some flexibility. But at the end of the day, if you don't want to do that, the registrant ID, which is how it is now, would be put in all of those fields. So is that a major shift?
Yes.
It could be viewed that way, but it could not be viewed that way.
I agree with that. And... I also acknowledge that, because we talked about this on Monday, I think, I also acknowledge that what you think is an acceptable minimum number of points and I do might be different. But all we've done is to make a series of recommendations.
Yeah.
The fight, if you will, would be in the PDP to say whether or not you want this or that. Now, we can disagree, but and we'll go, you know, So I'm not. So bouncing it back. What I'm saying is bouncing it backwards and forwards here may not necessarily achieve all that much.
But just that. Okay.
But there's doubtless a higher point.
Yes, can I go on to the question I had for Michaeli, which is a different question? Okay. Let
Michaeli.
Michaeli, I understand there was a really, and this is the mind-boggling tough question of the morning. Sorry about this.
Yeah, you're not sorry. Come on, go for it.
You're asking Michaeli the mind-boggling.
Meeting between the registrars and the board, having to do with the tape validation. I think it was this room.
You mean yesterday?
Yesterday. With the validation and verification process that's taking place now under the 2013 RAA.
Okay, so you're referring to the where we gave some the data on the number of domain names that have been suspended so far and under the 2013 RAA.
Right.
Yes.
Sorry, this is a question almost as complicated as the report. Sorry.
Okay. Just. Go for it.
So, and I understand that there was discussion about law enforcement requirements and that a request for data from law enforcement regarding, and again, I wasn't there, so it's all hearsay, a request for data from law enforcement.
I can tell you what was said if you want, so that's no longer hearsay because I was sitting there.
I want to tie it to this meeting. I'd like to ask you to tie it into what we're asking for here. So I understand the registrars asked for data from law enforcement about whether all the effort of validation and verification is really worth the end product and the difficulty and the millions of domain names being taken down. And that there was a suggestion that before law enforcement asked for more, they kind of have to show that what they've already asked for is working and necessary and producing the benefits and kind of the cost-benefit analysis is working. Can you tie that into what law enforcement has asked for from the EWG, what law enforcement has asked to be included in this report, and tie it in?
I don't think they asked for anything.
When you say you're going to ask me an awkward question and it's going to be potentially the awkward question in the morning, you really weren't exaggerating, were you?
Sorry, no.
No, you're not sorry. It's okay. I'm going to kind of throw this back at you in kind of reverse. The conversations that the EWG had with law enforcement were not specific to the EWG, in that nothing, and now somebody else can correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I'm concerned, nothing that we really discussed with them was new or novel. It was more a case of an ongoing dialogue, a continuation of dialogue that law enforcement had been having with contracted parties and with the broader community via the GAC and not via the GAC, with registrars, with registries, et cetera, over the last few years. The difference is that it was dialogue as opposed to them kind of yelling at us, which was kind of nice. There is a thing that that came up. Yes, it came up previously in other meetings, and it came up yesterday. Is it worth the effort? Is there an actual benefit? Is forcing some level of validation going to actually lead to a reduction in whatever, be that fraud, be that identity theft, be that phishing, malware. Choose whichever form of DNS abuse you're most passionate about. And I don't think that having that conversation is incompatible with what we've been doing, because we were asked to come up with something that met this big, long laundry list of things that the community and others had asked for with respect to who is over the last X number of years. So I would, and this is just me personally, if somewhere along the line somebody said, okay, there is absolutely zero benefit and what is being asked is ridiculous and is totally pointless and doesn't bear any relationship to anything, and you as the community decided that you were happy with not doing any of it, well then fine, grant. But that's not what we've been hearing. I mean... The balance thing here is, like, just speaking personally, I don't know how to get that right. Because if you say to me, Michaeli, hand on heart, do you believe that validating an email address or verifying an address is going to solve online crime? Personally, no, I don't think it is. Because if I was going to go out and commit a crime, I would probably validate and verify. Now, the thing I have said repeatedly, again, speaking personally, not speaking on behalf of anybody or anything, is that I am personally sick to death of everybody piling everything in on top of Whois and kind of using it as a proxy to solve the world's problems. You'd swear to God that, you know, going down the street and walking in, and walking around London is somehow safer because of some rubbish to do with Whois, whereas I could just as easily get hit on the head with a glass or something in the bar. I mean, I don't know. It's like as if this massive kind of kind of dichotomy between online and offline.
You should turn the mic off.
I could turn the mic off. But I, look, that you know, they're two parallel things. I mean, we were asked to deal with a big, long list of things, which we did. And is it going to solve the world's problems with respect to crime and all that? I don't know. And I wish that law enforcement and the GAC would actually come to us with something tangible and with something saying, yes, this did solve something. This did prevent something. And that would be fantastic. That would be great. Is it likely to happen? I doubt it.
Thank you for the tie-in across types of meetings.
Absolutely. I think Fab wanted to say something, Kathy.
So, Kathy, I think I wanted to come back to this. I think it's really important. I just had a aha moment. There's really more. I think it's the second cup's kicking in. It's almost done. Yeah, exactly. So twice now you've asked, or you've made the statement that we've made, from one meeting to the other, we've made optional mandatory.
Yes.
And that it's in the report. It's a chart, right? And I was thinking back on how that happened and why it is every time you ask that, I kind of make this confused face. I do that often alone, but in response to your question, I do it too. And I think the reason is, you know, I find myself, it's like I'm in this argument or discussion I have with my UK friends. Is it a banana or is it a banana? It's a semantic question, really. All we were trying to do is, in the chart, change it to mandatory, meaning that field needs to have data in it. But what I think you're implying or you're interpreting is that it requires additional data, meaning you must have an attorney, you must identify somebody new. It's not at all. It's just saying that something needs to populate that field or be designated to that field. Just like when I order a pair of shoes or something or a tie online, I type in my credit card information, then I get to a field that is mandatory that says your billing address. Now, I can put something new in it, or I can click the box that says same as billing. It doesn't mean it requires additional information or that I'm required to get an attorney or that I'm required to do anything other than so that when someone comes in, and it's actually meant as much, you know, the other question Milton asks is what's in it for the user? What's in it for the user is that now there's not this empty field where somebody is writing you personally for a legal matter when you don't want to be contacted or that they are writing you when you want to be contacted in relation to whatever data you've decided to add to or not add to. It's just like the company knows where to ship the information. Do they ship it to my billing address or do they ship it to my mom's house?
Kathy, I agree. I have some sympathy with your point about if I want to provide a legal contact, I can do so. I agree with that. But look at it from the other way around for a second. If we have, because I think this is a benefit to registrants as well, if we have a legal inquiry, so let's assume that a particular type of legal purpose is an acceptable legal purpose. We have a legal purpose inquiry. If we don't make the filling in of the legal contact box mandatory, then what information will we give the legal purpose query? So we'd have to go to another box to give them information. And I would rather give you the option of giving me someone else's details in that box rather than your own details as the registrant, and the option of giving me the registrant details in the box if that's what you want to do. So I'm not suggesting that my argument is better than yours. I'm just suggesting that there are different sides to it that work for both registrant and inquirer.
And
I hate to do this. I'm going to plead ignorance right now because I left all my notes about the database field back at my chair and came up to talk about something else. So I will be back to talk about database fields when I have my notes and when I have my old hat on as a large-scale database programmer. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this, but I know Chuck wants to talk about permissible purposes or something like that.
And by the way, Michaeli, it's banana. It's banana. It's not banana. It's banana. Okay. You say banana. I say banana.
You probably need some coffee, too, because this is Fabrizio, not Michaeli.
Sorry. Yeah. I apologize, Michaeli.
I confuse the two all the time as well. What Chris was just talking about, and just my interpretation of this as well, which I think, and how we viewed it in the group, I think what we've done, to a certain extent, with these new in theory contacts, is just reflect reality. In that, you are going to, if you register a domain name, there is definitely a chance that somebody is going to want to reach out to you on a legal basis. And then what we've done here is said, okay, that's going to happen, and they're going to reach out to you for abuse issues. They're going to reach out to you for whatever other. We had a couple other issues.
It seems that Chuck is going to be usurped again because Kathy wants to say something. No, that's okay. It's fine. This is what this is supposed to be.
Yeah. Done, so what we're doing, that purpose has been filled by the registrant this entire time, right? In the current system, that's where it is. What we've done is expose that people. I think what's happening is a visceral reaction, and some of this, we had some of this in our own group. Is like, whoa, that's new and different, but it really isn't. It just we're exposing, saying the emperor has no clothes, and this is what's going on, right? This is we're exposing reality to how things are done and how people need to be able to contact.
I pleaded with you in Singapore. And I spent hours with Denise asking if you were going to sit, in addition to holding many meetings with law enforcement and with people who act as private law enforcement, whether you were going to meet with free speech attorneys, freedom of expression attorneys, and registrant defense attorneys to find out how this data is abused, how every field that has a positive use has a negative use, and how new fields that you were thinking about might have negative uses. I've checked with everybody I mentioned as a name, as an expert who deals with this data and deals with the abuse of registrants every day through the WHOIS. Nobody was contacted. So let me ask you, did you sit down with any panel of registrant defense attorneys and or free speech attorneys who deal with this stuff every day, who deal with the abuse of registrants through the WHOIS every day, to find out what the implications, what the risks might be of what's being proposed? Sorry, Chuck.
I'm going to stay back.
Matt, you look as if you're reaching for the microphone.
Yeah, I think I'm giving that confused face again. I guess if my point was to clarify that we're not asking for anything additional, actually, in fact, what we're doing is giving the user the option to not have to add additional information where they don't think it's necessary, i.e., when I order a shoe or a tie from the online, because a shipping address is mandatory doesn't mean I have to come up with a new address to add in that field. How is that raising or triggering any different privacy laws or harm or anything? Meaning, if Scott registers a domain, and when you get to, and let's defuse this, instead of using legal, there's also admin, and there's tech. So let's stick to tech, because that's like a non-inflammatory subject, right? So let's stick to tech. No one has problems with technology and tech contacts. So when Scott registers a domain name, when it gets to the subject of mandatory collecting a tech contact, he's going to check same as billing, because he's capable of answering his own technology questions. Me, the dumb attorney, when he gets to the registration and it has the field one of many, along with legal and tech abuse, I'm going to not check same as billing on tech, because you'd be in the wrong box or calling the wrong person if you want me to solve a technology question. Instead, I'm going to say, check, Chuck is my tech person, or my neighbor is my tech person, or whoever. It's made to be easier. But if at the end of the day, I have no one and I don't care. You can call me and I don't care. I'll just say same as billing. It's an option, but it doesn't require you to add additional information. And because of that, I don't see how it triggers anything different in abuse.
Because my mother said, whenever you sign something, you're responsible for it. Whenever you check something, you're responsible for it. Legal contact means something. Abuse contact means something, and millions of registrants don't have
well, it. It's a, okay, so I'm glad, hold on. So I'm glad you're pointing this, because this is kind of to Wendy's question the other day about a new obligation of accountability. So I think we clarified when Wendy spoke that the registrant's already under the obligation to put in valid address and information. I think the registrant agreement, when you sign it, also has a lot of verbiage around what you're legally responsible for, i.e. what you're on the hook for. And the reality is, we heard Stephanie loud and clear on this. I mean, she was a great advocate for you guys, right? So we say, who did we talk to? I mean, we heard plenty from her on all of these subjects, every one of your questions from Monday to today, every point. We've spoken about this. What we try to do here by making a purpose-based driven model for which every time someone registers a domain, at the outset as they're registering it, they're highlighted all the different purposes, right, was another educational piece and another option to actually highlight, raise up to the level of lowest common denominator to let people know that someone may contact you for a legal purpose. There is an obligation. That already, in the current ecosystem, with or without this, is an obligation that everybody signs to, your mom and my mom included, all right? And the reality is, and we heard loud and clear, people don't know that that's the case, or they're not reading, or they're not understanding it. Now you're going to have an agreement, and you're going to get to a point where, if you didn't already realize it and what you signed for when you were paying, you're going to now be highlighted. And oh, by the way, someone may contact you because of what you just signed. There are obligations for tech, abuse, legal. And so, again, what we are trying to do is actually make it easier for the consumer to, one, understand what they just signed on to, and two, the availability to actually assign other people or themselves, but under full understanding of what it is they just signed. It's not to hide the ball. It's not to create, and it doesn't create a new requirement.
Hold on.
And again,
hold on.
It's mandatory that something be there.
Stop. I know Stephanie wants to say something. I actually think we need to carry on this discussion because I think it's really important. And Chuck is standing there, so we have a choice. Chuck, would you like to? Can we break for a little while, take a little bit of heat out of it, ask Chuck's question, and come back to it? Is that okay with you, Kathy? I'd rather break it and now, and then we'll come back to it, and Stephanie will be the first person to talk. Chuck.
Chuck Gomes. A few questions, first of all. Who is the chair of this PDP working group that's going on, and was this approved, this PDP working group?
What PDP working group?
Just stay with me, please. Okay? Yeah. Be patient. Yeah. Okay? You've been really patient so far. Did the GNSO approve this PDP working group that's going on right now? What I'm saying is we're getting way ahead of ourselves. What we are doing right now is what the GNSO PDPs, probably plural, will have to work with. There seems to be an assumption that what you guys put on paper is a done deal. It's not. The registry stakeholder group, at the very beginning when this process was announced, had one problem. We wanted to make sure that this group was not developing policy. Now, what we've seen this morning, and probably we'll see more of, is illustrating the challenges that are in front of us. You guys have laid some things down. Are they perfect? I don't think any of us believes that. You don't either. Are there possible errors? Probably. Can things be worded better? I'm sure. And we're going to have to grapple with all of that when we start getting into the policy development process. We're not going to resolve it today. I'm glad you can defend your case. I'm glad Kathy can defend hers. That's what we're going to have to do. And then we're going to have to try and come up with decisions, recommendations for policy that most of us can support. Will all of us support it? Not going to happen in this area. It's going to be the same. But we've got a place to start. And I think we need to get that into perspective. This isn't the place to iron all that out. We could go on for weeks. Unfortunately, the PDPs will have to do that. But let's keep the right perspective here. We could go on and try and improve the report indefinitely and fix all the... It'll never end. We're going to have to do that due diligence when we do the policy development. And we're going to reject some things, we're going to accept some things, we're going to change some things according to how we come together in some sort of a, at least rough consensus in terms of what we're going to do. Thanks.
Thanks, Chuck. Matt, did you have a... No? Okay. Stephanie, did you want to say something?
Well, I totally support the previous statement, just in passing, and Chuck was very patient waiting at the mic. Stephanie Perrin, for the record. I just actually wanted to speak another language for a moment, and it isn't French. In this discussion of the paradigm shift, if you wanted to speak social construction of technology, and it's to the heart of this argument about whether the words need to be correct in the charts and in the rest of the document. And as you might know by now, I believe we do need to clear up some confusion. If I may use an analogy, as Fab does in his filling out the form to get the shoes, a chum of mine who lives in Washington told me years ago that they actually put the lines at the stop signs so far back from the intersection that in order to safely execute the intersection, you have to creep past the line. Therefore, you're violating a law and you can be stopped at any time. That is what in the sociology, social construction of technology, we call an instantiation of power. And what I see in the paradigm shift that we are working on right now, we have a system that, yes, says you should have workable contacts, but according to all the evidence, and not being an ICANNer for life, like so many here, I only am relying on the evidence we've seen. It doesn't work. So when something actually doesn't work for so many years that it's full of garbage and people get away with registering as Mickey Mouse, then that is an instantiation of power that is relatively weaker. Now you bring in a system where you validate, then you do have to be very precise and careful about how you're calibrating that balance. Now, yes, that has to be done in the PDP, and you can blame Kathy for getting me into this business and McKaylee for talking me into joining the privacy proxy working group. And that experience has caused me to believe that we need some precision in what we throw into these working groups before they start fighting it out for the next few years. And I would quote Mikey O'Connor, who came to the mic, was it in Buenos Aires or Beijing, and said, whatever you do, give us more detail before you give this to the working groups, or nobody is going to sign up for them. And that's, I think that's a fear. I agree with what Chuck Holmes was saying, but where do you find the balance that you are not precipitating into the working groups what I would call a new instantiation of power? And that's what I'm concerned about.
Wendy.
Thank you, Wendy Seltzer, with a question in the spirit of Chuck's to give information to the working groups that will be processing this. Could we get an answer to Kathy's question about which privacy groups and advocates on behalf of registrants you discussed with, you met with or heard from in preparing this material?
We relied on team members. We have several team members, Carlton, Michael, Stephanie, that have that expertise. We relied on our own expertise. We relied on comments. And I did, because of a death in the family, did not attend two of our meetings. So London and D.C., I can't speak to that. But I only remember meeting with law enforcement for like 45 minutes once. So there's not been an overemphasis on the, you know, and in working with law enforcement. Now, you can go back and see everyone that's commented. Everyone had the opportunity to provide comments to us, and you've all done a great job of that. But, you know, I do not see that these scales were tipped one direction or the other.
I think that's right. I'm going to go to Jean-François in a second, but I just want to address what may be an implication that some of the changes that have been made in, and specifically to what Kathy was talking about, were because of discussions with law enforcement. In fact, my recollection, very strong recollection, is the only discussions we had with law enforcement were basically about how to validate law enforcement. In other words, how do we find a way of making sure that a law enforcement query is actually from a legitimate law enforcement agency? We had no discussion with law enforcement about the purpose-based contacts or anything. JF?
Yeah, because I think, Wendy, you are bringing a topic that many, many people are, in a recurrence way, bringing us this to our table. Number one, we have accepted 100% of all the comments, all the desire, all the requests for meetings, we have accepted. Full stop. That's number one. Number two, don't be confused about quantity and quality. And yes, we have Stephanie, we have Carlton, we have Michael, but above all, privacy is for every one of us to incorporate. And if we don't take privacy seriously, we are not doing our job correctly. Full stop. And I don't want any more this is coming to as a question and, okay, it's only Stephanie. It's not only Stephanie. It's me. It's Carlton. It's Susan. Is everyone around this table been very conscious that without the respect for privacy, we don't do our job. Now, yes, we have had fantastic speakers for privacy. Michael, Carlton, and Stephanie, as a specialist, as the people who understand far beyond what I can understand. But our mission for all of us is to incorporate privacy. If we don't have one dimension, one fundamental dimension in our equation that we have to solve, not correct and not incorporated, we have not done our job.
I want to come back to Wendy first, then back to you.
Lonnie
would like to talk. I'm sorry, Lonnie.
Okay. If I may add, I think we spend more time on issue of privacy than any other aspect of the program. And if you look at the major concepts, new ideas that came in the area of privacy. For example, gated access is about privacy. Secured, protected stuff is about privacy. So most of the new introductions into the system is about privacy. So I don't think privacy has been less discussed than other aspects of the system.
Thank you. I wasn't meaning to make any implications about the privacy expertise of anyone on the panel. I was merely asking the question, whom did you consult with? And I've gotten the answer. Thank you.
Yeah, but the thing is, this is coming all the time. And you have to be convinced that we have done privacy a big, big priority. In terms of airtime, in terms of discussion, in terms of intensity, this has been very, very much put on the table and a very vivid discussion and very honest, intellectual honesty. Very, very strong.
Stephanie. And then I think we'll go to the next person in the queue.
I think, as my colleagues might have politely said, I was a vocal pain in the neck on privacy at every meeting. That doesn't necessarily mean I was effective. I would just like to say for the record that I'm not an attorney. I'm not a data protection litigator. And Kathy's question actually was about the bar that defends people in domain. Somebody can phrase this better, probably Wendy, but not specifically about privacy. So in that particular case, we had two kind of lacunae there, and nobody came forward to give comments from those particular areas. So I think it is an issue. I just want to clarify that.
Yes.
I have a who is question. Who is law enforcement?
That is an extremely good question.
I live in Woodstock, New York, land of peace and freedom, and there's a big peace sign in the center of town. And when I first moved there 35 years ago, there were two policemen full-time and one part-time policeman. We now have 18 policemen full-time and 7 part-time.
That's not just
policemen.
Because you moved there, though, presumably.
Beg your pardon?
It's not just because you moved there.
Well, it may be partly, I don't know. But in addition to those policemen, there are 7 groups which are armed and come under the banner of law enforcement. There is the Ulster County Sheriff's Department. There is the New York State Police. There's the FBI. There's the Department of Homeland Security. There is the Department of Environmental Protection. And more recently, the U.S. military has been cleared to actually take part in law enforcement in the United States. So who can any one of those people get information about me?
Yeah. So you can understand how, as an English person living in Australia, most of that is complete mystery to me. I mean, if it's a policeman or it's, you know. But the answer is, this is one of the most difficult problems with the current system. What is an acceptable... If you allow law enforcement a greater level of access, then you have to say, what is law enforcement? And the way that... And it's currently a problem that's being dealt with the 2013, I think it is, RAA. Who wants to address the law enforcement issue? Rod, go ahead.
So, and we asked that question to law enforcement personnel ourselves, right? And there's even more authorities, the IRS, and I'm just talking to the U.S., the IRS, the FTC, there's a whole bunch of people with enforcement powers or investigatory powers that can you know, depending on the jurisdiction you're in, can obtain information about you within the current law of whatever that jurisdiction is. Right, so that, and actually, that's about as close to a definition of law enforcement as you can get in a way, is that if they have some sort of power within the regime or the local jurisdiction you are, then they have some sort of access rights under some sort of process, typically due process, hopefully, to be able to get information about you. So if you take that as a baseline, then you can actually start thinking about how you would apply that. And that's one of the reasons that we've... As we're going through this, we were struggling with that same issue. It's like, okay, how do we provide access credentials to law enforcement? And then somebody mentioned the dog catchers and law enforcement officer in a way, right? You can get a ticket for having your dog poop on somebody's lawn, right? So that's where we said, did you have that happen lately? one of the ways that we move this process forward is to say, let's take a look at the way that this happens in the real world. So if you take a look at how we've looked at the validation and accreditation around validation, we've said let's utilize processes that are already being used in existence for deconflicting and pushing forward requests for information between, and this is really an international border thing because this is the real concern is. And so we had, Interpol has already stepped up to say we're interested in providing our, a way forward to utilize the system they use for authenticating requests and the validity of those requests, because this gets back to a question that came up on the last session, is how do I make sure that the law enforcement request, which could be legitimate within the country it is in, right? I want to know who wrote this defamatory thing about the great leader. I want to know whether, you know, they're in a different country. Well, Interpol already has a way of deconflicting those and saying, you can't find out about that. You can't use a system to do that. However, we will help you find the pedophile who has been sending, you know, creating child abuse materials and posting them online. So there is a real-world system for doing a lot of what we're talking about already. That is a starting point. And there's still questions around tax authorities and things like that as how they would actually utilize the system. However, what we've done is created a framework so that this community can accredit those under rules that they would be able to get access to that information. And that policy would be, so there would be, the way we framed it within the document is that there would be a panel or of some sort put together to say, you need to meet these criteria. And by the way, when you are accessing this information, this is what you're entitled to. You have to declare that as your purpose, and that when that access is occurring, that there's a chance to be have that audited and make sure that abuse of that system isn't happening, so that the dog catcher is not going and, yeah, and pulling down the information of everybody that lives everywhere in the town, for example. So that's how we've tried to address it within the document.
And there is still a huge amount of work to be done, but it is based on a couple of principles, which if you don't agree with, then it doesn't really matter what the rest is about, because one does not fundamentally agree with the principles. So there's a principle effectively that you've got to provide information in order to get a domain name. And secondly, then there is a principle that law enforcement has a right to access that information. Now, having defined what law enforcement is and being very clear, etc. So if you don't agree with
those... wouldn't they have to go to court to get that? I mean, it just seems like... Any cop can...
Well, that's what we're saying. We're saying that there needs to be a validation system, and then there needs to be a permissible purpose rod.
And clarify that, too. It depends on the kind of case and the kind of work that they're doing. So you have particular incidents where you would have a court order, and it could be a sealed court order. There's all kinds of... This happens today, right, where domains are under investigation because they're being used for, you know, back end of a botnet and things like that. Sealed orders come in, and there's a court order, and then the registries have to respond to that and provide information. Happens today. There's also the kind of the more general investigatory type of thing when you're seeing some sort of crime occurring, and you're trying to who or what might be responsible for doing this. It's a different level of information you might be able to get for that thing. So it's not just your law enforcement, you get to look at everything. I think that's very important to understand that that's not what we're talking about here. It would be more finely grained than that. If you were doing a preliminary investigation, you would get a lighter weight set of data. If you have a specific thing with a court order, you could go in and get far more details about what's going on. And that, I think, reflects, again, trying to reflect how we do things in the offline world and try and make that show up there.
Well, in a number of CCTLDs, that is what happens. I mean, Australia being one, where we don't allow. So we publish a very limited set of data in the Australian whois.au whois. We do not allow law enforcement to have unfettered access to the database, to what's behind the gate. They have to come to us with. We have a series of agreed protocols. Now, admittedly, it's easy for us because we know who they are. Right, so we know who Australian law enforcement is, and that's the real challenge when you go global, right? But it does happen locally, nationally, in a lot of CCTLDs that these things that we're talking about already effectively exist. It's just a question of figuring out where's your bottom line standard that you're going to adhere to, and then how do you validate, accredit, if you like, authenticate law enforcement globally. Stephanie, you had your hand up, and then we'll move on.
Yes, and I think your question speaks to something that we did discuss in the group. We have said that accredited users of the corral, as I'm calling it, they get the data for particular purposes, and then They're not allowed to dump it into a giant database. Now, the enforcement of that mechanism is already difficult in the world that we have right now. For a number of Western countries for many years have been bringing in what they call joined up justice systems.
Yep.
Where, you know, indeed, if I have a complaint about my dog barking, somehow that's going to show up on my passport information when I try to get into the United States. You know, something, things like that are happening. And policing what happens in police information system is a true challenge. Fortunately, not one that ICANN is responsible for. But we do need to figure out how to police that that precision that we put on the release of the data. Otherwise, it's a nonsense. Why build an expensive system if we can't police it?
Yeah, and as I think we all talked about, and we all agreed. You know, you can only it's never going to be perfect, but at least we need to build in the checks and balances to ensure that we can spot patterns and see what's happening. And so when I say we, it won't be us. Thank you, David.
A brief note. I understand that there are a lot of checks and balances built into things like the Interpol system for, between jurisdictions. But it's also my understanding that there have been accusations that that system doesn't work. Particularly, one of the more high-profile ones was the 2012 case of Hamza Kashgari, who is his alleged Interpol system was used to prosecute for blasphemy, which of course should not used under the system. So I'm just wanted to say, in case it's important that we have other checks and balances for people who are cautious about, who are not fully confident in those systems. And in particular, in the extremes, I think the it is very important that I think it's a wonderful feature of this new system that it allows for the genuinely secure credentials that Stephanie talked about in the presentation on Monday, and I applaud the committee for allowing for that possibility. So, thank you.
Thank you, David. Kathy, do we want to revisit?
Sure.
Fred, are you heading to the microphone? Sorry, yes, Susan, go ahead. Sorry, I apologize. Go ahead.
Before we go back into the legal cut. No. This is totally different.
Sorry.
Oh, thank you. I never remember to turn on my mic. So this goes back to several questions of, who did we talk to? And I just, I'm sort of getting the sense that maybe we need to tell the story a little bit more about how we went about our work. And yes, there was two board members, Chris and Steve, on the team. But staff supported us. Staff was not part of the team. We discussed issues, we came to hurdles, and we said, we need more information. And as a team, we said, who do we need to talk to? And, a lot of that, as I remember, we wanted to talk to CCTLDs and, how did Nominet do this? And, what's going on in the real world today? And as a team, we decided together, these are the hard items we're having to deal with, and maybe this is a resource. Staff, could you please provide that as a resource? I do not remember any time that staff said to us, you will talk to these people. The staff came to us and said, these are people that want to talk to you. Do you want to talk to them? But this was all the research and the discussion, any of the work we did was driven by the team. Mm-hmm. And so it is a team consensus on this report. There is a dissent, and that's fine. But there was no, we made those decisions as we went through our work. And then we asked for help. So, maybe someone should have come to the team and said, please, please, please go talk to this person. And then as the team, we would have decided.
Which, to be fair to Kathy, is what I think she said she did in Singapore. But nonetheless, Kathy, Carlton wants to say something, and then we'll get to you. Okay, Carlton.
Thank you. Carlton Samuels, for the record. That's what I wanted to bring up about it in terms of the privacy. We had a sub-team that was prepared to look at the data protection and privacy principles. We did not request from staff to meet with any outside team. What we did was that we agreed as a sub-team that we would look at the strongest possible data protection and privacy regime that existed, and we looked at the principles that were enunciated. I wrote the first draft for the framework for the discussions after that, and we got together as a sub-team and looked at these principles. And where we thought we could augment the principles, we did that as a sub-team, and then we reported to the entire group. And the entire group then had a discussion about those principles. And I want to emphasize that the privacy and data protection principles took up, relatively speaking, a lot of the discussion around it. So I want to put that on the record. We did not ask for outside help. That is the way it usually goes. If we needed outside assistance, we would have asked staff to arrange it for us. But we felt at the time that the approach we took was to look at all the privacy regimes that we could find, all the data protection regimes that we could find, extracted the principles, created a document that framed those principles, argued among ourselves about the ones that we thought were weak or whatever, and then we presented to the entire team. That was the methodology. Thanks.
Kathy.
Kathy Kleiman. Carlton, no one's arguing that everyone here put heart and soul into this report, and enormous amounts of time, effort, unbelievable. The questions that are being asked have nothing to do with the effort that went into the report. They have to do with the product that we're trying to decipher, which came out very recently. It's very long and very frustrating for those of us trying to decipher what the words mean. So the frustration you're hearing from the microphone isn't personal, guys. Nobody's trying to attack you. Everybody did the best they could. This is very complicated stuff, and how privacy emanates out of free speech and free expression laws versus how it emanates out of data protection laws. We've been wrestling with this for a decade here, more than that, a dozen years. I mean, this is hard stuff. But how John Berryhill, who represents registrants, knows who his data is abused, and how registrants, under the guise of trademark infringement claims, it's actually anti-competitive claims. Somebody, a big boy, is trying to drive out a small competitor or a new entrepreneur who's entering into their field, and they're using a trademark claim, and they're using that data to find a home-based business. I've experienced that for 15 years. That's why I'm here, guys, because the abuse I saw 15 years ago was enormous. And so I was just trying, I think Wendy and I were trying to plow further into whether you met with some of the registrant defense attorneys. It's not personal. You did everything. You spent all the time. But is there more? Were there other experiences? Again, not just of those who use the data, but those who are abused by the use of the data. And so that's just what we're pointing out, is that there are a lot of people on your panel that use the data. There are a few people in the world that specialize in the abuse of
who it is. Can you, I understand that, and thank you very, very much. Can you help me? Because there's a couple of things that I'm not clear about. I would have thought that, so if your starting point is that you register a domain name and you fill in the information in Whois, unless your starting point is, I don't care about all that, I'm just going to lie and put in Mickey Mouse, unless that's your starting point, which I don't think it is, then currently the situation is that the data goes in, unless you proxy hide it, the data goes in. Surely it has to be better for your small business, who might be subject to a trademark abuse, that the person who may be doing the abuse has to, A, go through a whole series of steps, not gates, steps, in order to get the information, and B, his, her, or its use of that information can be monitored, or rather the fact that they requested that information can be monitored, so that, for example, I decide to go you for on a trademark, I go to David and get David to get the information in the system. We know he did. So surely all of that stuff, plus a whole heap more, has to be better than what is currently the case. So I don't, help me understand why that's not the case. I don't understand why.
That's the question you were asked to answer, and now you're asking me from the microphone. So I'm gonna. This is. I'm still trying to understand what's been offered, and then I can weigh: is it better or worse?
But I understand, and I'm not asking you to specifically answer it now.
If you have a bunch of validated data, and it's all public, and here I brought the database fields up this time, that could be a problem. If more of it's public than now, and you're making assertions as to legal contact when you're really not the legal contact. But, you know, that's the big question. That's the question we're all going to have to answer. You know, I'm looking at everybody. You know, is this better or worse? But nobody questions the goodwill that was done in putting this together or the enormous effort. Okay. No. But let's ask a question about accreditation, because
sure.
I don't want to go back to arguing about database field yet. I'll do that in a second. That goes back to another point in my life, and it's I was a, you know, database programmers have a hard life. So here's a question about accreditation and the ability to find abuse. So let me try this. On Monday, we had the president of the International Trademark Association, as I understand it, was in the audience. So let's say INTA becomes an accreditor of its members. Help me through the process of what you're thinking, not ultimately what will be adopted, as Chuck said, by the PDP, but what are you thinking in terms of accreditation? If there are differences, you know, feel free to share. So my understanding is, you know, say INTA becomes an accreditor. It can't differentiate between its members because a trade association can't do that. So it accredits any law firm that comes to it. Who in the law firm has access to the data? And let's say David, I'm picking on you. Let's say David has a problem. He's contacted by a law firm that's been accredited
yeah.
by the International Trademark Association, and he wants to complain. He wants to find out who it was that contacted him because it was really not trademark infringement. The underlying issue was really anti-competitive activity. Trace me through the process.
Absolutely. So just from my personal point of view, I would argue that if you are an overarching body like that, and you cannot not accredit your members, then you can't be an accreditor, because that actually defeats the whole purpose of being an accreditor, in my personal view. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I don't think anyone else, I don't know if anybody here would argue with that, but it seems to me that if you simply have to automatically give credits to your members, then you shouldn't be an accreditor in the first place. Is that right? Okay, so that's the first point. Can you just use the microphone, Carlton?
It's Carlton Samuels. Yes, of course, you're right. And furthermore, there is a standard that has to be adopted, and we have to know what that standard is for accreditation. That is the idea.
Rod, and then Stephanie.
Okay, yeah, and I can address the process question there, because we did. This is a great question, because it's like, great, now we've got accountability. How do we enforce accountability, right? So you'd have, and so this example into is one we actually discuss as a possible accreditor, because they do have international reach, etc. So you would create, you know, you create a set of standards, and this would be the policy development process would do this, right? And then you would have, okay, great, so for this kind of purpose, you have these standards, and then you, the accrediting body, whether that's INTA or some other organization, says, okay, well, we're going to hold, we want to have apply for our members. Members have to, that want to use this system, have to agree to that standard. They don't all get automatic membership in it. They have to agree to meet that standard. They get equal access because they are a trade association, but they still have to meet whatever the standard is. So from that point, something happens where somebody has a complaint. The key there then is then that person could take that complaint to the RDS operator or the oversight committee that I get, however that gets created, and say, I've got a complaint. My information was utilized for this. And because we've been auditing and tracking what's going on, you could actually say, okay, well, this person or this group did access this information. That would then get pushed to the trade association, who has agreed to uphold the standards and the purpose-based contacts, right? And one of their members had violated that terms of service. So then you'd have whatever the sanction regime is. And that's, again, that's a PDP thing for us to figure out what that regime looks like. But that could be something like they don't get access to the system for whatever, or there's a fine, or there's some sort of accountability measure that is put in place at that point.
And yes, and equally, I'm not sure if you said this or not, but equally, if just because an overarching body accredits, the actual entity accredited has its own validation ID, so we would know it was them rather than the overarching body. Because I think part of the thing you said was they would appear as if they were making the query on behalf of the overarching body, didn't
right,
you?
It's not clear whether.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't. I don't think that should.
Is it going to be the
that
Saudi
should not
government
happen? That should not happen.
Or is it going to be Interpol that's going to be it shown would, as the
I, that one I can't answer.
The data.
Rod, go ahead.
Yeah. He wants to say something. Yeah. No. Well, again, it depends. The law enforcement one is kind of a special case because there are some issues around ongoing criminal investigations, which are much vastly different than a trademark kind of case or some other abuse issue, right? But the idea there is that you would have a unique identifier for using the system. Whether or not there's a proxy in between or not, it doesn't matter. There would be a way of tracking either directly through the RDS or by going back to whoever's running the interfacing system to say this entity made this request for this data and there was an abuse that happened and when we want to redress that.
So if I have to go through a dispute process with the International Trademark Association to find out who it was that accessed the data of a registrant versus if I can go to the RDS and as easily find that gated information for the inquirer as for the registrant, which model are you thinking?
Well, personally, I would much prefer you to be able to go and find out who'd queried your database.
Directly.
Me too. That's my personal view. And I don't think there's anything in our report that would stop that from happening if that's what your policy said.
Does the report speak to it one way or another?
I'm
and
not
I apologize
sure.
for not.
Don't think so.
Okay.
Don't think so.
Can I jump in here?
Yeah, go ahead.
If I had a whiteboard, I'd do a dreadful diagram here. But if you are under a data protection regime, and hopefully there will be either a policy that provides the same rules or a high level of rules, or you'll be in a jurisdiction where there's a data protection regime, you would have a right to find out who accessed your data. Now, I'm talking as an individual here for the moment. So, and that right has to be free, not something like a UDRP type of process. So we will have to build a system for a data protection regime that provides you access, okay, who got my data, and I want to know exactly who, and I want to be able to correct it, you know, and ensure that there is a repercussion if there is a breach, because if somebody, and frankly, the insider abuse tends to be either over love or money, you know, ex-partners or anti-competitive. So,
or anti-competitive ex-partners.
And people who do that in data protection regimes, you know, there's supposed to be repercussions for people who do these breaches. So, once you've built that system, it doesn't make sense to put business through some very expensive UDRP. You yeah. already have the mechanism built for the privacy side. So I don't know why you wouldn't just get that data and away
Absolutely.
You go.
Because I don't live in a country with a data protection regime?
We'd take you, you know, in Canada.
You can move. It's not a problem. Or maybe we should incorporate the territory and country of ICANN, and then we can just do what we like.
Well, recognize that we probably will be creating some kind of harmonization.
Well, this is That's true. And just so that we're clear, no offense to any Americans who are happy with their current system, but I think it would be fair to say that this working group, pretty early on, you know, moved towards looking at those benchmarks, non-US-based, you know, non-US regimes, where there were, you know, data protection, privacy laws, etc. There was dispute about which one was better than the other, and Stephanie, of course, was, you know, pushing the Canadian view, and Michael was pushing the European view. But fundamentally, we all acknowledged that, you know, the US thing, you've got to move beyond that to create something that will be workable around the world. Sir?
So I'm currently in law enforcement. There's a whole different kettle of arguments.
Could you speak a bit more close to the microphone? I couldn't hear.
So I'm not going to get into Interpol.
Could you just introduce yourself?
My name's Adrian Cheek from the NCA.
Thank you.
So the question I've got is around the who is. We know the who is broken at the moment, and we know most of the data on there is absolute rubbish. But you've admitted yourself that this is probably not going to fix that problem. Now, as a researcher and as an analyst, I can use the broken data and still find my targets of who I'm looking for. I can use the terms and conditions which are already out there in the registrars to actually obtain data. I've never obtained a court order in 5 years to obtain data. I've never needed to, because there are rules already in place that I can use. In whichever country I choose, China, no problem at all. Canada, a little bit more difficult, but we won't go into that. So there are already things in place for us to do this. Now, as far as I can see, putting a non-law enforcement head on now, I can do 50,000 searches an hour, say, for example. A criminal, and just before I go in, has anyone got any law enforcement experience on the panel?
It depends on what you mean.
Well, has anyone been a police officer or a cop? Police officer or a cop in a particular country. So this is another concern I've got, is the approach that the panel have had to the report has not been thinking like someone who uses something illegally. It's been a very clean approach. That's what I've interpreted from the report. That's what I've interpreted.
Sorry, I think you'd find that we all thought about this report as somebody doing something illegally. Rod was our expert on how people might use it.
Well, from my point of view, then, the validation for a company is absolutely fine. There's a company contact, et cetera, et cetera. But the criminals we see at the moment are not worried about that. Customers do not look at the Whois data when they go to a website to buy something. This is one of our problems. They just go to the website, majority of customers. So they don't look at the Whois data. So they don't know that the website they are looking at has been registered by John Smith of 10 Downing Street, which is going to fall outside of the validation period or the accreditation.
So let me slow this down a bit, because we're in danger of getting lost here. I want to go back to the very beginning of what you said. Unless I misheard you, what you said was, as you've already admitted, these recommendations won't change the accuracy of the data.
No.
And I don't actually think that's true. I think we've said it will change the accuracy of the data. We categorically believe that what we have put in place will lift, to a great extent, the accuracy of the data. However, if you are saying, and let's just call it a criminal for all, bad actor, I think, is a term that we use quite a lot, would they be able to get around the system? Yeah, sure. I mean, in the sense that they could validate something that wasn't correct, absolutely. But I want to make it really clear that we believe that the garbage that is currently in the Whois there'll be much less garbage and much more accurate data. I'm going to come back to you in a second. Fab?
So I think we actually had a full discussion when we were in London for the second time or something, third time, about this. I think what you're getting at, which is that criminals will register websites, use them to defraud people or steal things, etc., before the validation process catches up with them. And by the time that it does, or cleans them up, or flags them, or what have you, the harm's already been done. Is that somewhere you can? Because I remember we had a whole discussion about this, and it was a whole discussion of, and it was three levels, because we had the syntactical, the operational, and then the, as Alex brought up, the identity part of it. And we had lengthy discussion, putting in context each one of those types of levels, how quickly you could and couldn't do things, what you could or couldn't flag, and what that meant. Did you stigmatize people who shouldn't be stigmatized in the system just because they weren't able to return their postcard in time? So up until that point, a legitimate user would be flagged. And those are types of things we struggled with. I mean, we went through systems like, could you do a credit card type system? Like when you change your postal address in the United States, they immediately write you and ask you to, you know, pay a dollar with your credit card so that they could at least have two different ways of verification. We went through systems to try to make it quicker, reliable. Could you do it through SMS, et cetera? And I don't know that there's any right answer, because we have to balance what you're concerned about, which a lot of us on the panel were concerned about, but along with, like, Lanre, you know, in his jurisdiction, we had a lengthy discussion about, well, how are you going to get the people in my jurisdiction? I mean, there isn't necessarily exact same postal system and accuracy. People don't use credit cards there. They use mobile cash.
And so we try to identify and deal with the issue you're bringing up, but the problem is every time we did, we found that we cast the net so wide that it actually left a lot of the world's population a little bit in a lurch. And what we didn't want, I remember Stephanie, you and I talked about this, was we didn't want to start flagging people in the system just because our system of validating them or a proposal we would put up would paint them in a bad color until they were validated, because as great as that would be, because it would, the net would be cast wide enough to catch the criminals and tip off potential fraud victims, in that bucket would also land a bunch of people who weren't fraudsters. They just, because of the system or the way their system operates, they, an example, didn't get their postcard back on the mail in time. So it's something that I think is a great question and something that hopefully you can help Chuck and the group through the PDP actually wrestle with, because we couldn't come up with the right answer.
So back to you.
Sorry, Stephanie.
Go first.
Just let me say, we've got 10 minutes, so if we could all try and be succinct, that would be helpful.
I was gesticulating wildly because I have been making the allegation, and I don't have facts to back me up, because the facts on identity theft are not very good in my jurisdiction, and globally they're not really helpful. But there is the risk that we're actually, with this validation process, driving identity theft, because now you cannot register as Mickey Mouse and get away with it. You've got to come up with, you know, we don't even have phone numbers that add up correctly right now. So we did say that we needed a full risk assessment. We did a little risk survey, but that's not the kind of risk assessment we need to determine what the impact of this is going to be. And if it's going to drive identity theft, then we need to go back to the drawing board in the PDPs. So please come to that.
So just a second part of that question. So even though the data is broken at the moment, I can use that data. So I've got a bad actor who's registering 5,000 domains a month. Now, if I left law enforcement tomorrow but carried on doing the work I do, because of what's now being potentially going to be put into place, I then have to justify why I'm looking at those 5,000 at a time. Now, what's to stop the third party, whoever ends up being the RDS, wherever they are, turning around and saying, oh, actually, you've made too many requests over the past 6 months for a valid reason, and then just turning around and terminating my contract. At the moment, I have protection because I'm law enforcement.
I'm the cybercrime investigator on the panel here, so I deal with this all the time. And we probably look up, I don't know, 250,000 domain name whois in a day for our systems. Maybe not that much, but it's a lot, right? So, and you know, we have rate limits that we have to deal with and all that, and registrars know us very well as a result. So the way the system's envisioned is that for you would be able to, I guess for lack of a better word, profile usage based on who's actually accessing the data. So we would fully expect that people who are looking into domains registered for botnets, which are typically thousands and thousands of them at a time, would be doing requests for those as they show up, right? And that would not, and this would get back to how do you balance the use of the system? It's fairly standard.
Also, what level of information on the, for a botnet query? What level?
Right, it would be a lighter weight of.
You might only need something, you know, one.
Right. Yeah, another thing too. Two more other points I wanted to make on this topic is one is that. There, if the criminal or bad guy or whatever you want is registering and using a pattern, those patterns will still show up in the ways that you did the data is put in the database. There would be whether it's contact IDs or whatever that they're using over and over again, DNS servers, all that stuff that we typically use is going to show up as patterns. The other thing I think that people tend to forget is that most of the domains that are used for abuse are actually innocent. They've been broken into somehow, right? So this is where cleaning up the garbage is really helpful from my perspective as an investigator, in that I could actually get a hold of somebody, the tech contact or the abuse contact that we're now, you know, providing, and really vastly improve the efficacy of our efforts to either find out more information or shut down malicious activity. So that's a big win, I think, for moving forward.
One last point, just on the profile side of things, Yesterday I was looking at a paedophile group. Tomorrow I may be looking at counterfeiting trainer group. How are you going to profile my uses based on the fact that I may not be looking at the same things every day, but I am making 50,000 requests for an email address per day? That's a concern of mine, because eventually someone somewhere will turn around and say, actually, there's no pattern to what he's looking for. It's just all completely random for different reasons. No more. And then I'm... Well,
so, but who are you in the first place? I'm not quite clear.
Well, okay, at the moment that would be law enforcement, but if I went into a private business tomorrow, I would still be looking at the same... Because at the moment, all that information is free.
But you wouldn't...
There's no restrictions to my accessing that data. But at some point, potentially somewhere along the line, someone's going to be authenticating that and saying, actually, no, and that third party is a concern.
Let Fab respond, then we do have to wind this up.
Yeah, so I'll be brief. So as I mentioned to Jay Scott when he asked this question in the morning, this is a PDP implementation situation. I mean, I think that for a lot of our report, you'll see principles, you'll see recommendations, but for the precise reasons that Chuck mentioned, it wasn't our job, and we didn't have any fantasy that it was our job, that we would actually boil this down all the way through implementation. We tried to do as much as we could to supply the facts, to give our reasoning, to show our process and what we meant, so as a guidance. But look, I and the IP community for certain is very concerned about the exact same things, and it's why I said to Jay Scott today, when the PDP process starts, when the community starts discussing, you need to hit on this point, because it really does all come down to what does authentication mean. Because during the authentication process, that's where those bells and whistles and knobs and levers get adjusted. And you need to make yourself clear to Chuck, to James, who was here earlier, and everyone else on the GNSO, and to the community, because it's vastly important, because the devil is in the details. And a lot of us all were completely fine with putting out principles and recommendations, showing our intent, but really relying on the community to actually put in the implementation. So we are not going to be able to give you an answer here, and we don't want to, in that we don't want to supplant what Chuck and the group are going to be doing with the community.
All right. So I think we've reached the end of our 2 hours. So fantastic. I'd like to be able to say, and in Los Angeles this, but I have absolutely no clue what in Los Angeles this will be, except it will not be, well, the board's accepted the report, so go away and implement it. We are expecting to enter into some fairly lengthy discussions with the GNSO about next steps. I think the board's formal process will probably be to accept the report, thank you very much, blah, blah, say all the usual things Fadi said and so on, and then move into discussion with the GNSO about things like we talked about the other day, about what should we do next? Should we get legal advice? Should we do a risk analysis? Should we do this? And then the goal being to build a package of the expert's report plus ancillary documentation and information, clear up any misunderstandings with FAQs and so on. And then I think at some point, and it's not going to be tomorrow, it's highly likely to not be before Los Angeles. In fact, it's practically guaranteed to not be before Los Angeles. We would then negotiate effectively with the GNSO. How do you want to do this? Do you want to do a series of policy development processes on chunks? Do you want to? How do you want to work it out? And then get those happening, resource them properly, because no one is under any illusions that you know you guys can do this on your own. You're going to need staff help and so on. So for those worried about the clash between the amount of work involved when it comes to the US stewardship transition and the accountability piece and so on and so forth, my personal feeling is that this will probably be hitting the road round about the same time that the other is finishing, assuming that we actually do ever finish the other, of course, which is entirely up in the air at the moment. So I hope that's useful to take back to your constituencies and what have you, just to take, and I really would like to take the fear out of this if I can. I understand that people get very concerned about, you know, what things say and so on, but and rightly so. But next steps are very, very much with the community, not with the board. Okay? Thanks very much, everybody.
Chris.